we'll go to 7, which is Brood Count Survey, which is Travis and Dr. Genke.
So, Mr.
Welcome
Chairman.
To South Dakota.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, this is Tom Kirsten again, Wildlife Division Director. And
hi, Tom.
Before Travis takes over on this, just again lead into this. Certainly, as we've had discussion over the last couple of months on the Pheasant Brood August Roadside Survey, there's been some more questions that have come up in respect to from the public and you as the commissioners. And so Travis has put together a short presentation to provide you a few more details on the Pheasant Brood Survey, some of the things that we've been talking about and looking at. And then we are pleased, as you just mentioned, to have Adam Genke here as well from Iowa State to talk about a project that we're part of that will provide a few more details and insight on some of the things that not only South Dakota but other Midwestern states that survey pheasants using a similar type survey are looking at to make that survey method stronger and look at some things that can help produce even stronger data. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Travis. Travis is going to provide a short presentation on some of the things that we're looking at from the South Dakota perspective and then turn it over to our primary investigator on this Midwestern project, Mr. Adam Genke. Travis, it's all yours.
Thanks, Tom, and good afternoon, Secretary Hepler and members of the commission. Glad to be here today to talk about pheasants again. I believe Chris Hull is going to fire up the presentation here. Perfect. All right. Well, like Tom said, my objective here today is really to go over the different population monitoring we do for pheasants in South Dakota and spend a fair amount of time talking about the strengths and the weaknesses of each of those surveys. So to start with, we have two different forms of population monitoring for pheasants in South Dakota that we've traditionally done. One is the August Roadside Survey, which is often referred to as the Brood Survey. What we get from this, or what we generate, is a population index. So this is a not a direct population estimate, but it generates a value that is intended to track with the population or correlate with the population. Another method is a direct population estimate. That's a procedure that is estimated after the hunting season with some different forms of data that I'll get into in a little bit. So each of these procedures is a science-based process, and they're both based on pretty much independent data sets that I'll talk about in a little bit. So for each of these surveys or procedures, there are different assumptions for each of them to be valid. And we're going to talk about some of those assumptions here today and how they can influence the results. And with that, each of these have advantages and disadvantages or strengths and weaknesses, and we'll get into that as well. But at the end of the day, you know, true abundance is difficult to estimate. And the true abundance is unknown, so it really makes population monitoring, it's easy to challenge the results, and it's often easy to scrutinize the results. So let's start out talking about the Brood Survey. That has traditionally been done since 1949. There are 110 30-mile routes that have been established across the state. And you can see that we have pretty good coverage across the entire pheasant range with a few routes farther out west where we have some smaller isolated populations of pheasants. These are pretty much kept the same every year, except for maybe really small deviations if there's a road closure or a bridge or something like that that we can't work around. But these have been pretty consistent through time to keep consistency in the results. So if we look at the methods for this, the survey occurs from July 25th through August 15th, which coincides with when most of our pheasant broods are still with the hen. So it's prior to brood breakup each year, but most of our birds are hatched by this time period, so that's kind of the time period when this occurs, and it's always been done that way. Our survey effort is directed towards basically mornings where we have clear skies, light winds, and most importantly, heavy dew. If you look at that bottom left picture, that's just your classic picture of what an observer might see while doing a survey. You can see the grass is soaked. Those pheasants are actually pretty wet in that picture. And basically, those conditions move pheasants either onto hay bales or open fields or onto the roadway, and basically for them to catch some sun and dry off their feathers in the morning. So we basically drive these 30-mile routes, count the roosters, hens, and broods, and come up with what we call a pheasants per mile index. So this is basically just adding up all the roosters, hens, and the brood times the average brood size and dividing by 30. Like I said, this value, the PPM index, is what we refer it to, It's basically a value that is expected to track with the true population if things are working the way we want them to. So what are some of the assumptions with this survey? Well, one assumption is that sampling is representative of the population. And for the most part, I think we're meeting that assumption with this survey. We have a pretty good sample size and pretty good spatial coverage across our primary pheasant range. We also want to see a minimum bias from our observers, and we do a pretty rigorous training and have protocol for staff to make sure that our staff are collecting data consistently. But probably the most important assumption with this survey is that pheasant observability or detection is generally constant through time. And what we mean there is if we maybe count more pheasants one year than another, we want that to be because there's more pheasants or less pheasants, not because some other outside influence dictated those results. And what we've seen from some of the foundational research that was done a long time ago is that the amount of dew on the ground is pretty influential on dictating pheasant observability. So we do direct our survey to mornings with a heavy dew. But, of course, we don't control the weather. There's probably years where we don't get those conditions, and that could be problematic, and we'll get into some of that in a little bit. So how do we measure the dew anyway? So we say we get to our pheasant route first thing in the morning and we look at the grass. Well, how do we actually determine if that's what level of dew is there? Well, for a pretty rigorous scientific survey, it's a pretty crude way that we actually categorize the dew. Basically, the observers have a protocol, maybe with some pictures of what heavy and medium and light dew looks like. They might walk around in the grass and see how wet their foot gets. But at the end of the day, it's a pretty crude method of documenting the survey conditions, and there could be bias that's introduced into the survey. Right, more importantly, is even when we do document a year where maybe the conditions weren't ideal for the survey, we really don't have a good way to compensate for that or correct for that. So maybe in the pheasant report during certain years, we indicate that the survey conditions weren't perfect, but we really don't change the value or change anything with the data to compensate for that. Let's once we turn it over to Adam here in a little bit, he's going to talk about maybe some ways that could be done to improve inference from roadside surveys. So at the end of the day, there's probably some bias in the results when we look at past data. So I just wanted to show you an example. This is basically our results of that roadside data going back to 1993. I've highlighted a couple of years there. Now, these are a couple of years where the pheasants per mile index increased by 100% or even over 100% for a couple of those years. And from what we know about the population dynamics for pheasants, we really suspect that that's pretty much impossible. It's not biologically possible. So that's a real obvious indication that there's some bias in the data, particularly with those 2 years. But there could certainly be other years where there's bias, and it's just not as apparent as those years. It's really something that results of roadside surveys could be certainly improved if there was a way to correct for or account for bias in survey conditions. What about some other potential bias in the data? Well, most of our surveys are completed, usually just once. If we land on a really good day, we have good conditions. But some routes are completed 2 to 3 times in an effort to get the ideal conditions. And with, replicates like that, there could be bias, and some routes are done one time, some routes are done 3 times. So that's another potential form of bias. You can click to the next one. I think we went backwards that time. If you click forward twice. There we go. Yeah, some other potential issues that could cause bias in the survey data, for instance, could be a late wheat harvest. We really know that pheasant observability during these surveys seems to be much better after wheat harvest occurs, and typically by the first week of August, most of our wheat is harvested. But there are certain years where that doesn't happen, so you can see that assumption of constant observability through time could be violated in a situation like that. And if we think about last year where we had millions of acres of unplanted cropland because of the wet conditions, there could be some potential issues there too, where pheasant observability is not constant between years, and really don't know what type of an impact that had on the results. Additionally, there's situations where traffic or disturbance along roadsides could impact the results if there's traffic on a road. So there's definitely no shortage of variability or sources of variability that can be in this data. But one thing that is kind of reassuring, if we want to look at ways to maybe validate whether this survey is providing reasonable results, is just to look at that pheasants per mile index and correlate that with just how many pheasants an individual hunter harvests in a year. And what you see there is actually a pretty decent correlation. Actually, that R-squared value there of 0.75, that just means that we're explaining 75% of the variation in an individual hunter's harvest success just by that roadside survey. Anytime in the biological sciences, when you're explaining 75% of your variability with a single variable, you usually get pretty excited. So there is a little bit of evidence here that the survey may be functioning reasonably well. So now we're going to switch gears and talk about our other population monitoring procedure, and this is a population estimate. I'm going to kind of present this in a pretty broad conceptual manner. The first piece of information that goes into this population estimate is our pre-hunt sex ratio. So from our roadside survey, we get a sex ratio basically from the composition of those birds, and it's usually pretty close to 50-50. Actually, be a few more hens than roosters, but just to present the concept today, we're just going to pretend that the results of the roadside survey were 50-50 in a given year. And just kind of keep in the back of your mind, what we're trying to estimate is the size of that pie. How big was that population during that roadside survey? So kind of keep that in the back of your mind. The second piece of information that goes into this is the post-hunt sex ratio. So this is basically after the hunting season, we're out counting large flocks of pheasants, sexing those birds. We get a composition count of how many are hens and how many are roosters. And since we're harvesting only roosters, that sex ratio changes. Obviously, it's going to be more hens than roosters after the hunting season. And one more piece of information that goes into this is the harvest. So we know in a given year, we survey our hunters and we get a harvest estimate. So in this example, we know that a harvest of 1 million roosters changed that sex ratio from 50-50 to 70-30. And you can imagine if the population was really, really big, a harvest of 1 million birds is going to have a less of an influence on changing that sex ratio. That's kind of how this works. If you click one more time, there is a fancy formula and some algebra that you can actually use to come up with that population estimate. I won't get into that too much, but for this example here, the population estimate would be 3.5 million pheasants based on this example data. So just like our August roadside survey, there are some assumptions for this survey to be valid and useful. And one of those is that the harvest estimate and the winter sex ratio data are wild birds, or majority are wild birds. And obviously there's potential here for problems when, if the number of released birds in the bag changes through time. You can imagine that if it's just 5 or 10% of our estimated harvest was released birds and that value stayed the same for 25 or 30 years, your population estimate might be a little bit biased, but it would be constantly biased through time. Where it gets more challenging is if the number of released birds in the bag or in the sex ratio data changes through time. Then all of a sudden your population estimate is biased, but also your trend data would be biased since that's changing through time. So I'll talk about maybe how some of those things might be happening in some of our data here in a second. So we have two different population monitoring efforts going on here. And of course, if these are functioning the way we think they should, or they're both functioning correctly, there should be a pretty strong correlation between these two data sets. Of course, it is possible that they could correlate and one or both could be inaccurate, or there could be certain years that certain estimates are inaccurate. But one thing that we should be looking for is if there's a lack of correlation or if there is a decoupling of the correlation, that could be a symptom of a problem or a red flag. If we just go ahead and we'll just plot the data here. This is just the bar graph there is our population data through time. The line data is the pheasants per mile. So these are our two population metrics through time. And as you can see, they do track pretty decently through most years, especially from, say, 1990 to 2012 or so. If you hit the forward button there one more time, I'll want to highlight these last 6 years or so. And what you can see there, it almost looks like that relationship is breaking down. The population estimate is much higher than the line graph there, which indicates that the relationship between these two population metrics seems to be breaking down. And one cause of that could be more released birds in the harvest estimate or more released birds in the winter sex ratio counts. That would be one way that the population estimate could get inflated and make this relationship break down. You will notice on here I don't have the 2019 data on here. The one reason is it wouldn't fit on the chart. We had a very weird year this year for our winter sex ratio data. To put in perspective, 2 years ago, the ratio for our winter sex ratio data was 62 roosters per 100 hens. This past year, it was 88, which shatters the previous record, and it's a really unreasonable number. We also had about seven or eight counties where that post-hunt sex ratio had more roosters than hens in the data, which is a pretty clear indicator that we're getting contamination with released birds in that winter sex ratio count. And that is basically making our winter sex ratio data for this past year inappropriate for using for a population estimate. So we definitely have some things to discuss with our population estimate and winter sex ratio data moving forward. One other way to look at this data would just be to look at a direct correlation between our roadside data and our population estimate. And those red dots on there are the past 6 years, the same 6 years I highlighted in the previous graph. And as you can see, all of those last, at least five of the six data points from the last year are way above that trend line. That just another indicator that that relationship seems to be breaking down. So to finish up here, there's definitely strengths and weaknesses for both of the population monitoring procedures that we've used in the past. If we look specifically at the population estimate, there's some pretty strong evidence of decoupling with that relationship with our roadside data. So we're getting different answers from our two different population metrics. And one cause of that could be more released birds either in the harvest estimate or the winter sex ratio data or both. And we had some pretty clear evidence from this past winter that we're getting more released birds in that winter sex ratio data, which is really making it challenging to do a population estimate that makes sense. These issues could be pretty challenging to address. As far as the brood survey, this is a broadly used population monitoring procedure for pheasants throughout the pheasant range, but there are certainly some biases that are out there, particularly related to survey conditions, and they're things that we have not addressed to date. But with that, there is research underway to try to look at our roadside survey data, both in South Dakota and throughout the range, and maybe looking at ways to address some of those issues. So with that, Mr. Chair, if it's all right with you, I'll just hand it directly over to Adam Janke to talk about a multi-state research project looking at roadside surveys.
Yes, please do. Adam, so that you know, at 2 o'clock Central, we need to go to a public hearing. So that's about 10 minutes. And so we'll try to be efficient. I don't want to keep you longer than we need to, but it might be that we have to stop you, I think, in about 10 minutes and then have that hearing and then come back. I hope that'll work for you.
Yep, that's great.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Thanks, Chris, for sharing some slides. First, it's a pleasure to join you all today from my home here in Iowa, where we're doing the same thing it looks like you all are doing, working from home and spending a lot of time on Zoom. Travis just gave a wonderful introduction to the premise of the project and the importance of the project, and I'll just speak for a lot of our other partners on this project. Many states are grappling with the same questions that South Dakota are grappling with in terms of most effective ways to monitor this important population. And so that's the impetus for our project that was sort of called for in the release of the National Wild Pheasant Plan and work by the National Pheasant Technical Committee that's administered by Scott Taylor, affiliated with Pheasants Forever. And he's sort of led, along with state pheasant biologists from a lot of these core range states, led the formation of this project. So, Chris, you can go ahead and advance. And let's go ahead and advance another slide just for time's sake. The whole premise of this project is essentially to do what wildlife biologists always do, and that is to try to estimate abundance of animals that we can't see. I know that the commission has surely seen lots of studies just like this come across your desk for pronghorn and elk and ducks and a bunch of other species that we're interested in monitoring. And what I always say to my students in my classes is that wildlife biologists, our job is essentially to do just that. It's try to estimate those animals that by nature of their wild behaviors are hard for us to see. So imagine we have a route that looks like this. We run that route on four occasions. We know that every time there were four broods along that route, in a perfect population monitoring method would yield the same or the truth. It would yield four every single time we run it. A perfect population index would yield the same value every time we ran it, so some sort of proxy for abundance. And one that is impacted by weather conditions or other factors like observers that Travis already introduced would yield highly variable numbers. So, Chris, if you advance to the next slide and click through a couple of things here, Chris, just for time. One right there should work. So here's some math. I don't mean to scare you away, but I want to introduce you to this idea of P, because that's the whole reason that we have this multi-state collaborative project, and that is to estimate the probability of detecting a pheasant brood along a route. So that is to estimate when it is that we, what proportion of the population we can see. If we knew the column on the right, the truth number, then it would be really easy to know what the detection probability is, because we would just take our count and divide it by the total number, and that would tell us the proportion that we count every time. And you can see down in the bottom our abundance estimate with some simple math using that probability of detection along with the total number of birds we counted yields the perfect estimate of the population. But, of course, as I mentioned, we can't do this very effectively, and so that's where it is that we need to do some experimental design and some scientific research to try to inform what that estimate of P is, and that's the whole premise of this project. So go ahead and advance another one, Chris. So imagine then that because we can't see those gray pheasants that I showed you, we don't know what the denominator in that equation is, then we have to do other things to try to estimate how many birds we were missing along a survey. So advance another one, Chris. And this would be, imagine a scenario where I just described that first example that I started with was our typical scenario where there's always four birds on a route, but we're only picking up about 40% of them. This is what the distribution of our counts would look like. And I'll spare you, Chris, advance another one. I'll spare you the mathematics that go into this, but trust me, there's some interesting statistical models that can basically allow us to figure out what that probability of detection is by replicating surveys multiple times across the study area. So advance to the next slide, please. Question is, what is our detection estimate? Is it constant through time? It could be really small, but as long as it's constant through time, as Travis said, that's not a problem. If it's variable through time, then we do have a problem. This is some preliminary analysis that the graduate student leading this project here at Iowa State has done with some data from Kansas, where they replicate their surveys four times every single year. So they survey something like, I think, 50 routes or 60 routes across the state, and every single route gets surveyed four times in the exact same way. And from that, we can do what I just described to estimate what the detection probability is, and you can see it ranges from something around 35% to something as low as 15%, and it's variable through time. Advance to the next slide, please. So you can see if we were consistently counting the exact same number of pheasants, say one pheasant per mile, through time, we would say our population was stable. But after correcting for the detection process, that problem of imperfect detection, we can see that our populations fluctuate a lot more. And so Travis sort of painted the picture for the applied context. I am trying to paint a picture for how it is that we know we can do this. And now I just want to share with you sort of the direction that we're going with this project with South Dakota support and with the support of a bunch of other states in the pheasant range. So advance another one. One, Travis already introduced this nicely. Lots of stuff influences pheasant counts. Some of these things vary through time. Some of these things vary through space. And we are going to, in our study, try to figure out how each one of these factors contributes to that estimate of P, or that estimate of detection probability, and improve our ability to estimate population abundance or population trend through time. Advance to the next one. Last year, we started all this. We did it with 13 different states. No, there's not pheasants in all these states. Well, there kind of is, but some of these states are also surveying bobwhites. It was an effort to try to make this useful to states that have bobwhite and pheasants in their range. But we did 13 different states, 33 routes, and 323 surveys to try to ask if this was even feasible, to try to start to build these estimates of detection from across the pheasant range. Go ahead and advance, Chris. We used these dew blocks to measure dew, and if you advance to the next slide, that's because in the 1950s, a study down here at Iowa State actually set us off on this track of understanding why pheasants respond to dew conditions. Here's the correlation that they found in the 1950s, that as dew, as measured by those little blocks that I just showed you a picture of, increases, the number of birds detected on their two routes here in north central Iowa increased as well. So that's why it is that we do surveys on mornings with a lot of dew from that study in the 1950s. Advance to the next one. We know that dew varies across the range, and so here's those routes, and they're scaled now for the amount of precipitation that each route gets. And you can see that figure on the right is a little bit more hairy than I have time to explain, but essentially we got a lot of variability in dew conditions across our study area. And advance one more. And we found that it really wasn't quite as clean as that study was in Iowa back in the 1950s. In fact, if you look at the two lines for South Dakota on one route, the correlation with dew on the left was really strong and positive, as we'd expect. And on the other route, it was really strong and negative in the exact opposite direction, as we wouldn't have expected. And so we found out in the pilot year that there's going to be some challenges with some of this work related to dew. And we're actually trying to collaborate with some people that understand how to estimate dew for things like mildew and other challenges in horticultural crop production to improve our abilities to measure dew conditions that may influence pheasants. Advance to the next one. That brings us to this year. Just so you know, we have at least seven states participating, and we actually just added Idaho to this today. So that'll be eight states, 60 or 70 or so routes, and each one of these routes, including a number in South Dakota, are going to be replicated five times. And that's going to allow us, if you remember back in the beginning, to build that distribution to start to try to estimate how many pheasants were missing and infer what factors are influencing or creating scenarios where we miss more pheasants or pick up more of others. So I think that might be the last. I have this overview slide, and perhaps this is what we could come back to in the discussion of where we're going with this, and I could also talk about the prospects for applying what we learn about detection to population monitoring moving forward.
Thank you very much. That was very well done, and it's 2 o'clock. You did perfect timing. Say, and Dr. Janke, do you want to continue? Does that work?
Sure. And had pretty much wrapped up what I had in terms of presentation for, in terms of the slides and things. And I think maybe Travis will have a better vision for how the discussion could go from here or questions that you all have.
Okay, thanks. Travis, do you want to comment, or should we just see who has what questions and comments?
Oh, yeah, thanks, Mr. Chair. I am done. I'm not sure how we want to proceed from here, but if there's any discussion, we'll stand by for any questions.
So, you know, there has been some question, comment, criticism of terminating or taking a break, if you will, from the brood survey while you participate in this Iowa State study. And I don't know how many of the public, frankly, actually know about this Iowa State study before today, which is one of the reasons we're happy that Dr. Janke can be here and help explain it. But it seems like one of the continuing issues, questions is what is the purpose of what management decisions or tools flow from or get used because of this brood survey? I mean, why do we do it? Are there any management decisions that come from it, or is it just a number that, you know, people can talk about at the coffee shop when hunting season gets close?
Yeah, I mean, we've had these discussions, you know, quite a few times, and we, definitely concluded that this data is not used for, setting season structures. It's primarily been used as a hunting forecast.
But I think I think it's good to think about more of the long-term implications of maybe not having population survey data. You know, one thing we could think about is, let's just say we go through a decade of time period without peasant population monitoring data. And maybe during that decade period, the narrative or message is the pheasants are fine, the habitat is good, everything is good in South Dakota. I do kind of wonder what kind of a position that might put us in, looking at debating farm bill in Washington and not having a message or population data for pheasants. Usually the money seems to flow to solve problems or address issues. And I do kind of wonder if not having data would put us in a position of strength or a position of weakness for trying to make those bids for conservation advocacy. Those are probably conversations that maybe need to happen with the people that are advocating for habitat in South Dakota, the folks that are writing farm bills, the folks that are advocating for different habitat programs. So I do kind of think of this as more of a long-term benefit of having population monitoring data. And certainly there's this other topic of using it as a hunting forecast that seems to be causing us problems, and that might be more of a messaging problem than an actual survey problem.
So, Travis, could you explain to us again, what are the concerns or inaccuracies or whatever the right word is for the way it's been done that leads you to participate with Iowa and Adam in this new study? What are you trying to get at? How would this brood survey perhaps be improved?
Yeah, sure. One thing I alluded to in the presentation is there are certain years where we know our survey conditions are less than ideal. And, at the end of when we report that data, we suspect that it's biased. So we may have a year where the population maybe increased 10 or 15%, but our reported value didn't reflect that. And that's certainly something we want to avoid if we're going to be reporting numbers to the public or using numbers for conservation advocacy. We certainly want them to be accurate and unbiased. And one purpose of the study would be to develop a correction factor. So if there would be a year where survey conditions were poor, there could be a formula developed to kind of address those shortcomings in survey conditions.
So even this year, you're going to run, 10 routes for this brood survey? Is that what you're going to do here?
Yeah, we're looking at maybe 10 to 20 routes kind of spread out throughout the region and doing repeated count or repeated surveys on these routes, so maybe 5 or 6 repeated runs. And some of those runs will hopefully be conducted with poor survey conditions, and some of those runs will be done hopefully with good survey conditions. And the whole point of this is to try to figure out what's driving variability in these counts.
So when do you think this survey will be done, or the study that you guys are working on?
Yeah, maybe let Adam take that. I think we're looking at a 2 to 2.5 years from now.
Yeah, it would be. So this is the first full year of the study, and next year, last year we called a pilot year, and then we're going to do exactly what we did this year again with the partnering states next year, and then combine those data to result in the master's thesis and sort of the recommendations for this first project.
Are there alternatives to this brood survey that biologists could use to come up with this pheasant per mile number, or is this really the only way?
I don't know if the question is directed to me, but I could maybe add a little bit to what Travis said also about the utility of a survey like this. Sure. One thing that makes it sort of unique is that it's a survey that's occurring after a major life history event, in this case being production, which, of course, for a resident animal is pretty important. And we have other ways of monitoring their population during another important life history, that is after the winter, through like the population estimation routine that Travis mentioned that the state uses, and also through internationally coordinated efforts like the North American Breeding Bird Survey. And so another sort of special utility of monitoring populations at 2 points in their life history is that we can actually separate what we call separate components
of the life cycle and identify where population changes are occurring. And so that's where I get really excited about this work, because as a wildlife biologist, because this allows us to ask questions about these resident populations, about are the population increases occurring during the summer, or are they occurring during the winter, population decreases occurring mostly during the summer or occurring mostly during the winter. And if we were able to know that, then we may be able to change the way that we manage, for example, pheasant habitat. If we found out that most of the annual changes in pheasant population trends, say through a declining 10-year period, were driven by what changed between an August survey and a May survey, that would tell us that the challenge is during the winter time. So maybe we need better wetland habitat, or we need food plots, or we need some sort of manipulations there. If we found, for example, that the changes in the population were explained more by fluctuations during the summer between the May surveys and the late winter population estimates and the brood surveys, then we know maybe we need brood habitat or nesting cover or something like that. And so as a wildlife biologist, this is a really unique opportunity to collect data on a species during multiple times in their life cycle. And it allows management decisions and conservation decisions to sort of be much more finely tuned to understand what's going on. So that would be sort of an immediate application that I see.
So would you anticipate that at the end of the study that everybody that's participating and perhaps others would basically come up with a format, and everybody would use, quote, essentially the same format, so there wouldn't be variability across the pheasant horizon, so to speak?
So I think Travis would be able to speak to that well because of his involvement with the National Pheasant Technical Committee, but that is one of the things that's been discussed, is some sort of multi-state collaboration on monitoring efforts so that each state is collecting comparable data. The idea is, even though pheasants are very much a resident species managed very much by state agencies on their own, there may be strength in numbers and sort of collaboration on that front. So that's my assessment from the ivory tower. Travis, I'd be curious what your assessment is too.
Yeah, one of the outcomes of this study could be, you know, having more comparable data across states. And for example, you know, in Adam's presentation, he showed that really tight gradient of precipitation and probably, you know, dew conditions for surveys. And what that difference really shows is that a survey for Minnesota or Iowa probably isn't comparable to Western Kansas. But when we're looking at, you know, large scale pheasant population response to land use, there could be advantages to having data that's actually comparable across state lines. So I think that's a pretty fascinating part of the study, is to actually be able to get a standardized metric coming from different states if there's a desire to count pheasants.
Will part of your study deal with the messaging of it? I mean, if we have a number that applies to the state of Iowa or the state of South Dakota, I mean, it's probably different in Hughes County than it is in Stanley, maybe, or in Brookings County or Union County. And will that be part of what your study is looking at, is how to package that in the most meaningful way, or is that not part of this? And I'm sure I'm not stating my question very well, but.
No, I understand your question, and I appreciate it. I think for this study, in the way that we design the work, this is really kind of focusing on trying to get at that estimate of detection, that p-value, and then also trying to understand what environmental and survey conditions influence that. So I would say that our role as on the science side of it is going to be to get it that far. But you are right that it would strengthen arguments, for example, what's going on in Brookings County versus Hughes County. If you knew, for example, if you had a route run in each county and you knew the environmental conditions during those routes, it would strengthen those comparisons, because you would know, for example, maybe Hughes County had really bad environmental conditions during their route and had few birds counted, and Brookings County had exceptional environmental conditions. We'd be able to sort of correct for those different counts. So that's an application of the work that I could imagine. But from my perspective and my role and the role of the graduate student on the project, we would be sort of stopping at the recommendations and then hoping that agencies and other decision makers could apply the work.
Thanks. Well, I should quit asking questions. Other questions, comments?
Mr. Chairman.
Commissioner Locken.
Yeah, Commissioner Locken here. Obviously, we're wanting to count pheasants now because the populations are, we'd like to see them higher. Every state would like to see them higher. When they had the initial brood counts, were they concerned with the population being too low, or possibly they were concerned with those populations being way too high and wondering when they'd level out? There had to be some problems back in the old days of too many pheasants at times.
I'm not sure the history of why the brood count started, if that was in response to too many pheasants or not enough pheasants, or just a desire to know. I don't know what the desire was back then, but there was certainly times where we had a lot more pheasants than we do now.
Other questions? Comments?
Mr. Chairman?
Commissioner Sharp.
Yes, I've enjoyed this presentation, and I think, you know, one of the things that both Travis and Adam have kind of indicated from a math standpoint is that if a perfect condition, if we can benchmark it at zero, let's say that's medium dew, 70 degrees, light breeze, that's your benchmark at zero. The next day you go out and the dew is light, you might give light dew a plus 10% rating on the number of birds you might see. If you go by cornfields, that's a minus 20 because you see more birds there because there's corn there. If you go by a plowed field, you might make that a plus 20%, you know, to try and adjust for all the discrepancies. And that's the one thing that I think has been pointed out in Travis's information from the last 6 years, how the data hasn't really followed what the population ends up being, really supports the reason why we're taking a hard look at this. And I also commend the Commissioner Whitmire with the effort he put into going back in history and tracking the birds per mile, the populations, the estimate of the amount of harvest. And I think those are all important things. And I've been very disappointed in some of our partners out there that would suggest that the reason we're taking a look at that is this is to deceive the public if we don't think the public's smart enough to figure this out. And this is all due to marketing. What it is due to is we want accurate data kicked out about what our pheasant numbers are. And if there's a better way to do that, I think it's incumbent upon us to pursue that and maybe go away from the things that, you know, worked 40 years ago, but maybe don't work today. And it really is trend data as opposed to a scientific, in my mind, a scientific approach, because there's too many variables there. If you're looking left, did you see the birds on the right? Is there heavy dew? You know, do we wait to do those routes and we only do them in perfect conditions, or we do it over a 5 days period? And if it's windy or not windy, if it's too hot, too cold, not enough dew, whatever, there's just too many variables there to really consider that being a good scientific approach to counting, in my mind. Travis's data the last 6 years certainly supports that. And he did indicate the 2019 data was so far off that they couldn't even, and certainly correct me if I'm wrong, Travis, but you felt the 2019 data was so extraordinary that you didn't believe it was useful information. And so, again, I think we're being responsible to take a hard look at this and how to better represent our true pheasant numbers to the world than what we have going on in the past several years. So I think we're on the right track, supported fully, and I'm kind of excited about the fact that there's more than just South Dakota looking at how to get better information out there. And again, I would ask that the people that our supposed partners out there, instead of having knee-jerk reactions, recognize that we've been looking at this for a year, and it didn't just come up one day and say, oh, what the heck, let's just change the way we count birds and see how it turns out. So we're on the right track. I think we're doing the right thing, and I'm glad Adam and Travis are on top of this. So thank you.
Other questions, comments?
Mr. Chair?
Commissioner Whitmire.
Yeah, Commissioner Whitmire. Yeah, thank you, Commissioner Sharp. When you pointed out the crop use or land use, I do think that looking at that, if it's a soybean crop today or corn, that which is most prevalent, I guess, at least in my area of the state, I think that important to whether the canopy for those birds would have driven them to the roads in a dewy condition. So yeah, to the people that are studying Travis and whatnot, I think that's an important piece of whether or not the birds are being driven to the road or looking for shelter from that. But very interesting. I'm grateful that we're having these conversations. But more than anything, I guess it feels like we're getting that, and we're going to hopefully arrive at a good place. So thank you all.
Thank you. Other questions, comments?
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Sharp?
Also, to follow up on Commissioner Whitmire's comments and his research, why globally, apparently, CRPs makes a huge difference in the amount of pheasant population, and I think our numbers would support that. The people that think that the by-county data totally supports that would be surprised to learn that some of our largest CRP counties don't have the largest number of pheasants per mile. So, again, the data, we need better ways of collecting information than just that. So, again, the knee-jerk reaction about us deceiving people is just not accurate, and I think we're on the right track here.
Yeah, and you know, we've always done it that way. There's no reason to keep doing it that way. We're trying to find the best, most current, accurate way to do this. So thanks again to Travis and Adam. Excellent presentations. We very much appreciate what you're doing. And Adam, thanks again for coming and sharing your time with us. And we'll look forward to hearing more from you in the future.
I'll look forward to that as well. Thank you for your time and support of the project.
All right, so 3 o'clock. Emily, how long are you going to need to do pheasant marketing update?
Mr. Chairman, I'm thinking probably about 15 minutes, maybe 20 at most.
Well, if it's all right with everybody, why don't we have you do that, and then we can take a break, our afternoon break after that. Is that anybody object to that? Oh, so the floor is yours, Emily.
All right, sounds good. Well, good afternoon, Chairman Jensen, Secretary Hepler, Commissioners. For the record, my name is Emily Keough. I'm a senior advisor to Secretary Hepler. So you'll recall at the June meeting, we talked in detail about how this marketing campaign came to be and the tactics that we'll be using to increase both resident and non-resident small game hunters over the next 3 years. So since that time, we've been working very hard behind the scenes and on very short deadlines to keep things moving. And we do have some data to report out on, which we're going to be sharing with you here just shortly. So joining me today are our tourism partners, Kirk Halstein and Mike Duchess. You've met them before. Mike's going to explain that one-page report that you'll continue to receive each month on campaign analytics. And then I'm going to come back and visit with you about some public relations efforts to date. So if that sounds all right to you, I'm going to turn it over to Mike and Hall. Chris Hall, can you please share that one-page report? There we go. Okay, Mike, you're on.
All right. Thank you, Emily. Thank you, Chairman and the Commission, for the chance to present and update you guys today on some of the things that we have going with this joint marketing co-op between the Department of Tourism and Game, Fish, and Parks. So We're pretty well standing, ready to enter the field, a field that, is really stretches from here to November with our results. A lot of things are in place with some things still, yet to finalize, but really we've taken our first steps. And so what we want to show here, too, is one of the tools that we are going to be, make available on a monthly basis where we can keep track and keep tabs on everything here. So, ultimately with this campaign, we have the goals of recruiting, reactivating, and retaining with that ultimate one, that we have identified previously of increasing small game license applications and to, help drive tourism tax sales through it. So with this dashboard that we've put together, the one-sheeter, here we outline the four KPIs that we're tracking to really see and, see how we're doing and meeting those goals that we've set out. So here with this piece, we have these laid up at front and center for you guys. So again, anyone at a reference can see on a monthly basis what we've been up to and what sort of impact we're having. Even though we've really only, had about 2% of our spend to date or 1% of our impressions, to goal to date, we are happy to, we already see some action. So 271 total license sales that we've been able to, attribute to really just such a small, small percent and portion of our campaign getting launched here in the past couple weeks. Site traffic, something that we're going to be looking at and reporting. Again, we really want to generate interest and see that interest come to bear in people seeking out information and finding what they want, hopefully getting those questions answered. And so here, first up, and what we plan to do with this, too, from Game Fish and Parks, the team there, the communications team is, really present a three-year look at it as well. So you can see, total volume. We can see how that trends. And then two things like because Game Fish and Parks is a growing brand and generally experiences a certain level of growth, this would be a way, too, where we can see what, might be typical or average and then where we see that marketing campaign really coming in and making an impact. So with website here, I think it looks like a normal website traffic increases are typically in the 20 to 22%. So this is where we're tracking to date or what's showing being tracked to date, again, with, likely as in the next commission meeting to see this increase dramatically as we start driving traffic through paid media efforts. Email subscriber increases, again, another strong KPI. We want to, see that steady engagement and really get those people opting in to receive messaging on a consistent basis. So you see that laid out there. The one thing that it does show a negative right now, but again, when it comes to those email lists, that's something those really do fluctuate, especially too with how we're tracking this KPI through the effort. This is based off of the number calculated for email subscribers is those who sign up for email notifications via the GF&P website. These are individuals who may be interested in South Dakota, but you have yet to purchase a license, apply for a license, or reserve a campsite. And so that's where once they do one of those actions, they get moved, and that's where you can see some fluctuations in here. Social following, really at this point, the 13% that's being tracked is Facebook, but we will have Instagram and YouTube pulled into this, to help establish a reliable baseline once we get some better analytics and a little bit more numbers included in here. So, again, this will be a tool that we'll have available for everybody to really track through these efforts. And then just to share, too, touching on this is just really a small portion. We'll track here at the bottom, how we are, give an idea of what we're doing, as our total spend, total impressions generated from that, and then total engagement, from this marketing campaign. This, too, is where we'll be able to see this on a monthly basis. Like I said, it really has been a pretty small, minimal efforts that have gotten launched. Really what's driving it, and as far as the 271 licenses to date, has been from our paid search efforts, our pay-per-click terms that we have out there, which are nearly 800 terms that we have put out there that are driving to about 41 different unique URLs. And this is something where that 9,700 engagements has come from that. So within a couple of weeks, some things that we've had shipped that we'll be dropping and adding, to this total spend, total impressions, and total engagements. We have the Pheasants Forever Journal, the Upland Super Issue that's going to be mailing here at the very beginning of August. We also have an opportunity with Cubby Rise that presented itself a couple weeks ago. and one of those last minute flushes, fire sales where we're able to jump in at a very discounted price and add to what we're utilizing to reach people. Also, we'll have a Quail Forever Journal, the next issue of that coming out. Also, late July, our Meat Eater, our 60-second mid-roll reads with the popular Meat Eater podcast. We're going to start our first flight there. And then we have our 30-second programmatic cable buy that was scheduled for South Dakota, Minnesota, Nebraska, Wisconsin, and Iowa starting soon. So we've shipped off that TV spot. Again, those flights will be coming up. So what's in the works with the marketing plan and what will be coming up in the next couple weeks as far as what else will ship and ready for deploying in later here in August or late July into August. We have 15-second videos for digital that we're finalizing scripts for right now that we're going to be cutting next week. Our banners, we've submitted feedback on that, and so that's something, too, that we'll hopefully get approval and get shipped off next week as well. Paid social, we've just provided this week some feedback there on photos and headlines to be used. Again, hopefully then get that started, shipped and launched, and ready to roll next week. And really a big piece, too, and something that we're really excited about is the Shields partnership. So this past week, the GF&P team reached out to lodges across the state to, you know, give the opportunity for everybody, you know, anyone willing or wanting to participate in this giveaway we're going to have, give them the chance to find out some details and potentially be a part. So we're finalizing talks with the one and need to finalize the legal and the giveaway specifics here this week and then run those by Shields. But that's something, too, where we'll have a pretty big partnership with that Shield, with Shields brand in-store signage through their channels, that sort of thing. Partners like Benelli giving away four different shotguns to be a part to go along with this hunt that we'll have in South Dakota. What's next after that, after the media and looking forward a little bit more? We don't have just one giveaway with this promo. We have two, and we'll be starting up some conversations with Hunt Stand, a partner that we've utilized in the past from the tourism side that's been successful, and we will be utilizing again this year. So we'll have a giveaway with them through their own channels that they've developed. And then also working on a Rooster Rush video project. So we'll start working on specifics for that. And then also start planning specifics for our own video shoot to have this September where we can really add to the assets that we have and the diversity of the assets we have for utilizing in the years to come as we're, you know, committing to this being a long-term campaign. And that's all I have to report from my end. Emily?
Thanks, Mike. So as you can see, a lot is happening next week. We will also be launching the campaign website with all of that, too. So stay tuned for more. On the public relations side of things, there's five key efforts that I just want to brief you on right now. Outdoor News is a hunting and fishing publication out of Minnesota for outdoor enthusiasts, and it's been in existence for the last 50 years. Managing editor and company president Rob Geislin interviewed Secretary Hepler and Deputy Secretary Roebling on July 6th. And in that interview, these gentlemen discussed the decision on the discontinuation of the brood count. They also talked about the Iowa State University research project that you just heard about. And there was also talk of habitat and habitat stamps, as well as addressing non-resident hunters. And this appeared in the print edition only last week. In terms of the second one, Sporting Classics magazine, just yesterday, Kirk Holstein and myself shared information with journalist and outdoor enthusiast Doug Painter on the background of the campaign and our existing partnership with tourism, as well as information on what makes South Dakota the greatest, you know, those traditions from hunting, access, and all memory-making pieces to determine the greatness of our state and the impact that we intend to make with our campaign efforts. This is going to publish in a digital edition only, which reaches 60,000 outdoor enthusiasts and upland bird hunters, and that will be released in September. Going back to Covey Rise magazine, Mike mentioned on the paid efforts that we engaged with a full-page ad with them. For those who might not know this magazine, it's an upland lifestyle magazine that captures that upland sporting lifestyle. It prints 6 issues a year. But this also crosses into the PR efforts. Next week, we're also going to have a visit with them, a discussion with them on possibly partnering on some other additional PR and content opportunities. So looking forward to that. Ron Scherer Productions has also reached out. So next week as well, myself and Kirk are going to visit with staff from Ron Scherer Productions. This company also produces The Flush on the Outdoor Channel, which seeks out some of the country's top upland bird hunting destinations. And Pheasants Forever and Federal Ammunition are prime sponsors, presenters of this show, too. So as many of you know, Ron Scherer is one of their hosts. It's all about the adventure of the bird flush. So we're also looking forward to seeing what opportunities could come from this conversation, but still more to come on that. Another one is we're currently working on a production agreement with Public Broadcasting to complete youth and educational programming on their show called Into the Outdoors. This is a show that covers everything from shooting sports, angling, exploring nature, science, ag, and it's all targeted at youth. Specifically, in our agreement with them, we'll focus on South Dakota pheasant hunting, of course, both for TV and the classroom over the next 5 years. This bridges back very nicely with our marketing efforts to really introduce a new audience, a new generation, through information and education that speaks directly to them, to the pheasant hunting activity. And so as we finalize this agreement and these timelines, we'll be sharing more information back with you. And I just want to shout out to one of our GFP team members, Heather Villa, for really helping see the big picture here and seeing this through for all of us. So with those 5 key PR efforts, I also just want to share with you on the social media influencer side, and this all ties back to our key performance indicator of increasing our social media following both on Facebook and Instagram, we've selected to partner with Steven Ranella with MeMeter as our prime social media influencer for this season. Why did we select him? You know, he's a bird hunter. He prefers hunting public land. We wanted someone with a connection or experience to South Dakota, not just a one-and-done experience. We also prefer somebody who's tied more to that experience than to a specific brand within the outdoor industry. So we don't want this to be an ongoing commercial on social media. It has to really create that feeling, that emotion, and that desire to act on the activity and information seen and heard from that influencer, all related to pheasant hunting and outdoor recreation in South Dakota. And obviously, going back to what I said earlier, we prefer somebody with that strong social media background over all mediums so that we can increase that KPI. Additionally, Jonna Ohm and the communications team at GFP continue to lead and maintain our daily and weekly PR objectives and strategies alongside these larger efforts. So that's really exciting, and I thank them for all the work that they do as they also explore local and regional influencers who also have that strong connection specifically with our resident hunters. And so with that, I would ask you, Mr. Chairman, if you or any of the other commissioners have any questions at this time.
Anybody have questions or comments? Questions? Comments?
I got a question.
Commissioner Olson.
Thanks. Emily, can you remind us how we're going to monitor the increased number of license sales due directly to our marketing efforts? Is there going to be a survey or some type of an event where people, when they make or book or plan their trip to South Dakota, that they say, I saw it on this station or they responded to this social media ad?
Sure. Mike? You want to address that, please? Thank you.
Yeah, so that's definitely something that's a big piece of it and something that's really been pretty involving with the GF&P teams across departments, all agencies, to get something in place. What we can do is there's some pretty advanced tracking, cross-domain tracking, where once we see someone that, and really with the, you know, this is mostly on the digital side, right? Offline, that's a different story, and I'll get to that, but you know, when it comes to anyone that sees one of our ads and clicks through, goes to the landing page, or, you know, hopefully we can generate that interest. And by using that unique URL, you know, if they see that TV ad and they're searching out Hunt the Greatest SD or huntthegreatest.com, you know, they and getting to that URL or unique landing page, any actions they take from that, we're going to be able to track what that action is. So that's our way that we'll be able to attribute, you know, what traffic is generated through these efforts, and then ultimately do they convert in that way. So it's something that, again, that has been pretty technical and really has, you know, taking up a lot of time on the teams, but something that once we get established and in place really does give us a pretty good insight into, you know, which one of our paid efforts are really driving, you know, and how do we see those converting and really giving us that additional insight going forward to inform our plans going forward. So long story short, you know, and then when it comes to some of the, and again, in that unique URL, you know, as I mentioned with offline efforts, that can get a lot more difficult. There's a lot more gray area there. But that's where, again, just by trying to use that unique URL that we can track through there. And then, you know, versus TV, radio, audio, or if it's print, you know, we can make some, you know, we can look at it and decide, you know, see where it's coming from and attribute it to a certain market or whatnot. That can give us some insights. Gets a little bit more gray there, but definitely with the digital and with some of these, we are going to be tracking and see what's driving what and using that information going forward.
And if I could add, I think we've documented like 35 specific ways on the back end, Commissioner Olson, directly tied to the campaign tactics to identify exactly what you're asking. How did they see our information? Where did they go from there? And did they buy a license? And what license did they buy? We'll be able to track all that. So as you saw the one-pager reporting document at the very beginning, that will continue to grow, is my assumption, based on the reports and the analytics that we get back and what we're seeing from this campaign to determine the ROI. Any other questions?
Questions, comments? Why don't we're going to put